And good morning to everyone out there. This is Dr. Z, and you're listening to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z Show right here on Progressive Radio Network, where we talk about issues in health, wellness, and alternative medicine. Today, we've been doing this a really long time, and we're really glad to that you took some time out of your schedule to listen to us either live now or on your podcast and supporting this great radio station. And you can always get more information about some of the things that myself and the Natural Nurse are doing, various walks and talks and webinars and things like that, by visiting the website naturalnurse.com. Dr. Kamai usually keeps our calendar there, and you can get information at drznaturally.com. So we have a great guest here talking about Ayurvedic medicine, but more from a self-care perspective, teaching you step-by-step how to not only use Ayurveda for your body, but also overcome and boost and stabilize your energy with some yogic and pranayamic breathing techniques, and overcome the transitions in the seasons. Like right now, we're experiencing it right now, particularly in places where you can feel the four seasons. You can really feel an energy shift, that's for sure. And undo physical and emotional stress with various yoga postures and also nourishing tonics and teas. And we have a really interesting guest, Dr. Sarah Kusira, and I hope I said that right, and she's the a chiropractor and a certified Ayurvedic practitioner. And she wrote the Ayurvedic Self-Care Handbook, Holistic Healing Rituals for Every Day and Season. So we're going to bring on Dr. Sarah here, and welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for coming and being our guest this morning or today. So anyway, how did you get interested in Ayurveda with your chiropractic background?
Well, when I was in chiropractic college, I was actually already practicing as a yoga student and studying to be a yoga teacher. So yoga and chiropractic happened almost simultaneously with me. But as you might know, yoga and Ayurveda are sister sciences. So after already practicing yoga and chiropractic for a while, I started to explore Ayurveda, and I learned about it first through yoga.
Yeah, that's a great introduction for a lot of people, that's for sure. But then as they look at the history and the complexity of Ayurveda and the materia medicas and the very advanced language that's spoken in Ayurveda, you know, their understanding of the tissues and the dhatus and the personality types and the doshas, it's bewildering to people. Plus, a lot of the great books are in, you know, Sanskrit or English with a lot of Sanskrit names of the herbs, and it's kind of bewildering, even for the Western physician, naturopathic, chiropractic student, and particularly the lay people. So it's, can you explain Ayurveda in a nutshell for us?
Sure. It's kind of a big nutshell, so I'll do my best.
Okay.
And I actually first would love to say that that was one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, the Ayurvedic Self-Care Handbook, because I felt like there was this vast system that was so useful to so many of us, but in a way it wasn't accessible because maybe you would have an interest in it and you'd go to read about it and the Sanskrit would turn you off, or it would become a little overwhelming in some way. And so I wanted a way that would keep the essence of Ayurveda, but in also some way simplify it so that people could understand that it's not as complex as it seems when we're talking about it in English instead of just in Sanskrit. So Ayurveda is a system of medicine that comes from India, and it's based in nature. And when I say this, I mean that it takes largely into account that we are a part of nature. And if we were stripped of technology, the ability to import and export foods, all the things that are really in existence to sort of make our lives easier, we right now in current day really might not know what to do. But of course, our body instinctively would say, you know, it's getting cooler or it's getting warmer, and look at what the earth has to provide for us in terms of food and nourishment and so on. So what Ayurveda is saying is that we have to look at how we are a part of nature. How can we coincide and exist within nature, sticking to the rhythms of nature and our own rhythms in our own way? And every person is viewed as unique, just like nature is unique. So our plants are different. They require different elements to survive. They may need more light, more water, less water, and so forth. And we could be looked at in a similar way. So nature is broken down into five elements, which are called ether, space, air, fire, water, and earth. And those elements are then in the human form put into things, into constitutions that we call doshas. And that's one of the first things that when you're learning about Ayurveda that probably becomes attractive to you, because it's sort of telling you, as you mentioned, like, what are you like? What is your mind like, or your body type, so to speak? And so that suggests that each person has different vulnerabilities, different tendencies, patterns, and different needs in the same way.
Yeah, what I find kind of complex, though, is that, like, even though we could be different doshas, we could have an aggravation of one of those constitutions. So, for instance, say, like, I'll give you a patient example. I had this lady, she was skinny her whole life, right? Really, she showed me pictures. Skinny. And then all of a sudden, she started to gain a lot of weight. It was, I think, after her third kid. So clearly, we think that something messed up her thyroid, which is commonly, at least the Western sense. But now she's very overweight. So she has this thin frame, but she is clinically obese now. So here we have someone who's, I would think you would say, a Vata constitution, who's now become Kapha. How could that be if we're supposed to have these doshas that follow us throughout our life?
Sure. So I could speak to this in two different ways. And one is that, and probably the most important thing to say is that no matter your constitution, no matter your dosha, no matter which elements are inherently strong within you, you can always have an imbalance of another element or constitution. So think of it as, your constitution was determined upon conception. So how your parents, what their health was like, where they were, everything boiling all the way down to the time of the day that it was that you were conceived. So all of these things are considered when your constitution is created, when you are created. Mm. That never changes. So I like to tell people that's sort of like your eye color or the size of your femur, right? You could maybe surgically change the size of your femur, but throughout your entire life, as you become an adult, your femur bone will be the same size. So that's like your constitution. It never changes. But we also have to consider that there's a principle that is said to be like increases like, or the principle of accumulation. And what this means is that if I am a airy person, so if I'm lighter in structure, like you're talking about your Vata-like patient, if she's lighter in structure naturally, and the things that normally would balance her would be heavier things, she might actually have more vulnerability to becoming air imbalanced. And the reason why is that that pot, or that bucket, however you want to look at that part on the chart, is already really high. And for things to overflow or to create symptoms or to create different manifestations within our mind or body, that has to increase beyond a tolerable point. And if that air or that space or Vata dosha is already high, it doesn't take as much air for that to overflow. So that person is more susceptible to becoming out of balance in the constitution of which they already are. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't add a significant amount of the earth element, let's say, which would normally balance her. So if she's trying to add the earth element because it makes her feel good and doesn't know when to stop the signs of, okay, I'm feeling good, now I need to check in and see, do I need to change my routine? Do I need to change my lifestyle because I feel differently now than I did before? Then she's at risk of accumulating too much earth, even though that was already lower in her, to the point of overflow, just like she could have with the air element.
Very nicely
said. Does that
said.
Seem clear?
I'm understanding it. Yeah, definitely.
And so I'm the sure other thing I'd like to mention that. Is that the increase in weight, it very much looks like that is always a kapha imbalance or always an earth imbalance, because that constitution is described as heavy. And so what I see when people come to me that maybe have concerns about their weight is they automatically, you know, they've done their own research and have decided I have a kapha imbalance because kapha is the heavy constitution. But what our body, as you know, is very smart and likes to try to repair and heal itself. So she could still have an air imbalance and be overweight. And think of how something that was really popular in retail recently was the weighted blankets, like the blankets that are used now more therapeutically to decrease anxiety.
Right.
That's essentially what her body is doing to her, right? So if she has an increase in these air-like symptoms, anxiety is an air-like symptom, her body will hold things to make it feel secure and grounded.
So you might work with, and that's very, it's very amazing that you fixed that, you mentioned that, because, she has a stressful job. So that may be a compensation for helping to ground her, to help her, because if she were to not have that grounding, she would basically lose her mind.
Exactly. She becomes so depleted.
Yeah.
And you have to consider the source. As you said, she has a stressful job. So what I tell people that come in and say, you know, if they tell me I have a kapha imbalance because I am overweight, then I say, okay, so that must mean that you've been eating heavy foods, you've been sedentary, you've been immobile. Those are the things we use to describe kapha, kapha activities and kapha lifestyle. And they say, no, you know, I've been overly active. I've been eating light foods. So you see, if you look at where the imbalance came from, you'll know much more about what the actual imbalance is.
Yeah, thank you for that. That makes a lot of sense. So you talked a little bit about that Ayurveda basically is based on the observations of these ancient rishis who were, basically looked at the universe and realized that we were like the microcosm of the macrocosm, and that we follow kind of like seasons ourselves, that the whole clock is broken into kind of like different times of the day where the various constitutions are ebb and flow. Can you explain that to the listeners out there? That's really interesting.
Sure. This parallels much our circadian clock. So our circadian clock, when we look at how our physiology is throughout different times of the day, we might see that our respiration rate increases naturally, or we have better lung capacity or breathing capacity, let's say in the afternoon, or we have a natural peak in testosterone or cortisol in the morning. So Ayurveda has something very, very similar to this, and it actually doesn't really contrast the circadian clock. It adds a different perspective and different detail to it. So what the Ayurveda clock is suggesting is that we have these four-hour time blocks. So if we looked at our 24-hour clock, there are four-hour time blocks that could be, we could say, are governed by different elements or different constitutions. So we have the time frame from 2 to 6 a.m., which is governed by vata or air. And this means that our tendency is to have stronger air qualities in our mind and in our body, and that we should satisfy those in some way, but we should also make sure that we're not overdoing it in any way. So this is, for example, a great time of day to have movement, that we would maybe choose to put our exercise at this time of day, because naturally that is what our body wants to do. It wants to move. In fact, that's when we would typically have more movement in our physiology, such as a bowel movement, or we eliminate in the morning. So there's already movement within the body, so we could do more of that. But if we go back to the example of your patient, if there's too much of that movement, then we've overdone it. So we have to be very careful that we don't tip the scale too far. So we have the 2 to 6 hour, which is attributed to Vata. And then we have the 6 to 10 time frame, which is the Kapha time of day. So this is it's our heavier time of day, but that also means that we're stronger, that we're steadier, and that we have a decent amount of focus. So this is also, of course, this is maybe even a better time for us to do physical activity in terms of balancing us. Whereas our earlier time frame would be a great time for a gentle, let's say, yoga practice or just a nice, easy movement practice that we maybe incorporate some breathing with. So in this time frame, we might find that we could sit and read, we could focus on something, but if we were to sleep too late into this time frame, we might feel very lethargic because this is already the heavier time of day. And if we haven't gotten up and gotten moving, then we risk imbalance again. And we have the 10 to 2 time frame, which is the pitta time of day, the fiery time of day. And this is when our digestive fire is at its peak. It's also when the fire in our mind, the sharpness of our mind, is also at its peak. So while we're able to break down food the best, it's also the best time for us to really do things that require great amounts of mental acuity. So let's say that you're trying to figure out your taxes. That's a time where maybe you need to have better focus. It's not the creative time of day, let's say. I mean, maybe you could be creative with your taxes, but I don't think your accountant would like that. So we have the 10 to 2, and then everything starts over again, the 2 to 6 in the afternoon, similar that we have the Vata time of day. And it's a time of day where we might feel lighter. Many people feel tired at this time of day if they've had excessive movement or mental movement throughout the day. So it's a great time to stop and to pause. And then we have the 6 to 10 again in the evening time, which is suggestive of us playing into the heavier qualities that we get ready for bed. And then back to the pitta time of day from 10 to 2, which is really when we should be sleeping so that the fiery pitta organs can do their work while we're at rest.
So if we kind of get out of balance with those types of things, this is where I guess ill health starts to creep in. Like say we stay up late and then we end up sleeping late. So now we're not getting the benefit of when these organ systems are healing whatever's happening in our body during these various periods of time. It seems like we're not, if we get out of sync, which is basically why you wrote your book, because your book is how to get back in sync, which is kind of cool, which we'll get to in a bit. But you can get out of sync with that, and then you may reach for the wrong types of foods, right? To kind of, like, yes. What was interesting is, a lot of patients come in and at 4 o'clock they feel exhausted and they go to, one of the coffee shops and get a cup of coffee. What was the 4 p.m. time again, Doc?
Yeah, that's the Vata time of day. That's between our 2 to 6 hour of the afternoon. And it is most commonly when people will say that they are tired. So if you ask your patients, what time of day do you feel the lowest energy? I would be so confident that most people will say like 3 o'clock or sometime between that 2 to 6 hour time frame. And you're right, most people will reach for a stimulant, but if we're looking at that they have an air imbalance, and that air imbalance, much like how wind can erode and deplete things, we feel depleted from the air element, which we could also call the wind element. It's like the winds of your mind or the activity of your body. And, in our culture, many people have a light lunch, which also then means that they've missed an opportunity to add heaviness to balance the air element. Oh. So while that person wants to reach, like their body says, like they have this craving that's actually pulling them deeper into an imbalance because they're using a false way of bringing energy instead of grounding down.
Right, with the coffee. So you recommend, I know in Ayurveda, that the middle of the day is the time to have the largest meal. We tend not to do that in America. Like we're totally eating too late. But it's interesting how, you know, you see in Europe, my wife and I were in Italy a couple of years ago, and these folks were eating gigantic meals, like, mm-hmm. late in the day. Of course, they used a lot of bitters and things to help their digestion, but I was just amazed. It was a very different cultural thing for me to eat then. But you're saying that the ancient rishis said that you should eat your biggest meal of the day at noon?
Yes, between 10 and 2. So, of course, noon falls into that time frame, and noon, as we tend to lunch at that time, that's definitely the most ideal time. And, you know, if we're getting tired in the middle of the day, I think it's pretty easy to say, like, food is our fuel, whether that's for our body or for our mind. And if we haven't adequately refueled in the middle of the day, how could we possibly have enough energy to carry out the activities of our afternoon and evening? But yes, the biggest meal is suggested to be in the middle of the day. And as you say, it goes against the grain of what we normally do. And, you know, I try to dissuade people from having business lunches for that reason, because when you have a lunch meeting, not only are you taking in food, you're also taking in air from speaking. You're taking in the energy of what the topic of discussion is, which business isn't always the most fulfilling thing, the most nourishing thing. And we have to digest everything that we take in. So you're sort of bogging your body down with extra things and then not actually giving it the nourishment that it needs.
So in the beginning of your book, with that background of Ayurveda in place now, you talk a little bit about, okay, you know, how do you know that you have obstacles to cure? How do you know that you really could need Ayurveda to bring yourself what you call a lifestyle shakeup? So you have mm-hmm. some nice questions like, do you feel you're doing all the right things to stay healthy? Is your energy consistent? Are you waking up at night or having trouble with sleep? Do you have brain fog? Digest? How's your digestive system? That's a really important concept in Ayurveda. How's your skin? And, you know, how do you feel emotionally? So, and spiritually as well. So that was really, it's a nice kind of way to begin the process. And you check off those things and say, yeah. And then you can, I guess, identify what practices you should be doing. But it's pretty complex, I got to tell you. I was looking through this, and I would need another day to just do my Ayurvedic things.
Yeah, so that's true. So it could be complex. You know? And something that I really want to emphasize is that Ayurveda really does, as I also suggest, and I think many people are now suggesting too, is that change should happen slowly, and that you can't just add all of those things into your life. And we do have to consider that this is from a practice that is from a long time ago, and, you know, thousands of years ago. And our lives were very different then versus now, and the things that we can realistically implement are also different. So in no way would I ever suggest you have to do all of these things to have impeccable health, to be of the best health you could possibly be. I mean, that would be wonderful. But someone could trip a cycle by just incorporating one thing. Mm-hmm. And when you trip the cycle, you often then, you know, other things start to fall into place, or you just start to feel better, and feeling better causes you to crave other things that make you feel better. I was talking to someone recently about this, and I use the example that if you come out of a yoga practice or you have just gone for a run, I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, and now I want a bowl of ice cream. Because after you've done something like that for your body, you don't necessarily want to refill it with something that isn't great for you. And I wouldn't say that ice cream is bad, and in many ways it could also be feeding your soul. But that's not what we would crave when we're already feeling well. So when you can just do one thing, you know, even if it just means using a tongue cleaner in the morning, which would add a couple of minutes to your day, or mm-hmm. drinking warm water in the morning, same thing, might add a couple of minutes. That's putting you on the path, and that's really the best thing that you could ask for.
or getting up a little earlier. It's funny you mention it. You're an author. I'm an author. I myself and the natural nurse found time to write our books with our busy, hectic practices. And that time, my kids were real young, and it was, oh my God, it was an interesting time of life, that's for sure. But I got up every morning and did my meditation and spiritual practices, and then I found time to write. And you're absolutely correct. The ancients were correct. That's the time when your mind is just power. Your mind and spirit are powerful, and just the ideas would just flow from the page, mm-hmm. or flow onto the computer, actually, because a lot of times I right. type the computer. Right. So yeah, there's a lot. That's the thing about this is that somehow the ancients figured out these truths. This isn't just a flash in the pan type of, you know, the latest fad. These are like ancient truths.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when I look at that, it's like they had to rely on their senses, the things that are most closely related to their well-being. We are relying on our intellect, which is great. You know, we never want to go against our intellect, but we're relying on intellect and technology to tell us. It's like if you look at the weather and it says it's going to rain and you walk outside and the skies are clear, which do you believe? And, you know, we're getting our information from apps, and they were getting their information from what they were experiencing and noticing through their senses firsthand.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, play one of our little things. But when we return, we want to get more into like some of the Ayurvedic things that people can do. You know, maybe you can give us some good tips on maybe we'll make up a patient or something like that and look at maybe how routines could change, how you could do certain things like you mentioned. You mentioned some mantras, you mentioned some really good food ideas, some nourishing churnas, you know, things that you can mix herbs with goat's milk or soy milk or almond milk, I guess, in this day and age, right, coconut milk, or hygienic principles or mantras and things like that. And you have some really good ideas and also obstacles, like if people find themselves getting derailed for a particular thing happens in life, how to get around that. So we'll get more into that when we return. So we'll play a natural medicine chest, and stay with us, folks. You're listening right here to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we'll be right back.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the essential oil taken from the Australian tea tree.
The tea tree, known as Melaleuca alternifolia, grows in only one region of the world, the northeast corner of Australia. It is a full-sized tree of the myrtle family, whose oil has powerful abilities to clean and help heal wounds and skin ailments such as cuts, burns, and rashes. In 1770, the infamous Captain Cook was a lieutenant in the British Royal Navy when his ship landed in Australia. The botanist on board, Sir Joseph Banks, collected samples of a sticky aromatic leaf and brought them back to England for further investigation.
In 1923, an Australian curator and chemist, Dr. Penfold, conducted a study on tea tree leaves and discovered that their essential oils are 13 times stronger as an antiseptic bactericide than carbolic acid, considered the standard in the early 1900s. The oil contains 50 to 60% terpenes, 6 to 8% cineol, which causes its camphor-like odor, and several kinds of alcohols. In 1933, the Australian Journal of Pharmacy, the American Journal of the National Medical Association, and the British Medical Journal reported that tea tree oil is a powerful disinfectant, non-poisonous, non-irritating, and has been used successfully in a very wide range of septic conditions. Australian tea tree oil is mentioned in the British Pharmaceutical Codex of 1949, the UK Medicine List, and the Dispensary of the United States.
During World War II, tea tree oil was considered a standard issue item for all first aid kits for Army and Navy units in tropical regions. The demand for tea tree oil exceeded the supply. However, after World War II, synthetic drugs gained in popularity and the use of tea tree oil in medicine waned. In more recent times, a renewed interest in natural, non-toxic alternatives has triggered a resurgence in tea tree oil research. In 1985, Dr. Paul Belacher, chief of the phytotherapy department at the Faculty of Medicine, University of Paris, worked on several double-blind studies involving tea tree oil and its application as a remedy for candidiasis, chronic cystitis, staph and strep infections, and nail bed fungus. He stated, and we quote, "The essential oil of Melaleuca has entered the team of major essential oils and emerges as an antiseptic and antifungal weapon of the first order in phytoaromatherapy."
Try a few drops of tea tree oil in a steam vaporizer and inhale for blocked sinuses, or rub the oil on chest and back for a cough. The Australian Journal of Dentistry reported that using tea tree oil in dental hygiene and in surgery showed it to be an extremely effective antiseptic. Add a drop on your toothbrush or include it as a gargle and mouthwash. Tea tree oil can be applied directly to the skin. Although it's possible that some people may experience a mild allergic reaction, in-depth research has shown tea tree oil to be non-irritating and safe.
So, listeners, think about including tea tree oil, the first aid kit in a bottle, in your natural medicine chest.
Okay, and we're back with more of the program right here on Progressive Radio. We're interviewing Dr. Sarah Kucera. Is that how you say your name?
It's Kucera.
Kucera, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the Ayurvedic Self-Care Handbook is a fabulous book that she wrote, which discusses everyday knowledge, rituals, taking that very, what people think is difficult to understand, Sanskrit information, and making it very practical with little self-study keys and things like that. Really found the book interesting. Now, for me, I find, and so I'm gonna make it my own thing here. sometimes I get out of sync doing exercise, you know. And so, what advice do you have for people? And I tend to be more kapha energy, you know. Mm-hmm. So I like to exercise, but and I feel great after I do. I wish I could keep that feeling great, feeling, and then motivate me when I don't feel like going mm-hmm. to karate because I'm a black belt. So sometimes I go just out of like, you know, it's going to make my master upset. You know, mm-hmm. I'm just being truthful. You know, so what would you say to get into an exercise rhythm for patients?
Mm-hmm. Well, you actually touch upon one thing, which is for some people, accountability is really one of the main things that's going to keep them in their routine. So whether it's a class where you don't want the teacher, you know, the teacher is counting on you to be there and you don't want to upset them. And of course, we don't want that to be the only reason that you go. But, you know, once you get there, that's the hardest part is getting there. Mm-hmm. And then you feel great and you're happy that you were there. So it's just something that might, someone that can get you started. I also like the idea of leaving notes for myself. Like if I get up in the morning and maybe I don't want to go for my morning walk, I'd rather stay in bed. I have a little note by my bedside or on my phone that will say, you feel better when you have your morning walk, or you feel mm-hmm. more in control of your day when you have your morning walk. So it is kind of like me reminding myself, you know, you feel good when you do this. And that might sound overly simplified, but I do think that that's something that could help us get into that routine a little bit better. And I think that changing what you do is really important, and it's not really looked at enough. And we look at seasonal eating, but we rarely look at seasonal exercise. Mm. And you can imagine that what our body needs as fuel changes throughout the year. well, the way that we're using our body is also different. So in the winter, if you're feeling like maybe I don't want to get up to go to my regular workout, and your workout is a very intense, like high intensity interval training, and that maybe isn't what we need in the early stages of winter, you might want to listen to that. And I think it's really important to know, if you're feeling tired, is that your body saying, don't do more movement, to listen to it? Or is that, in, you know, kind of how you use yourself as an example, is that you saying, you know, I kind of, it's great to be at karate, but I also like sitting. I also like reading. So it's learning when those cues are accurate to either to listen and to stay more static or to have more movement.
What about food, rituals for food? Because that's also, so either like sometimes people don't change the way they eat based on the seasons, or sometimes they just don't have enough time to do a decent grocery shopping, and then they end up falling prey to convenience foods, or what some other patterns that people would have, maybe eating too fast, too quickly, because they have a half hour for lunch and they want to, you know, eat this great pita meal and, you know, and then do some, you know, exercises or whatever. So sometimes our schedules are very hectic, with not, you know, not the 9-to-5 job, and you're home all the time, you know, at supper time, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, you're a practitioner. I'm sure you have a lot of hecticness in your professional life, too, because you're taking care of people and things like that. So what's your advice for when the world is topsy-turvy and you're trying to create some type of a pattern?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing to point out is to always do the best that you can. So if you are feeling exhausted one evening, you had a rough day, and you had the best intentions to come home and have a really great home-prepared meal, but you can only muster up the strength to go and get something that's pre-made, if that's the best that you can do in that moment, then that's the best that you can do. And you could also still have that meal in a very mindful way. You could sit, you could chew, you know, like 32 times, swallow it, and, you know, think about the food and how your body might be digesting it. So sometimes it's not even about the what, it's about the how. And so I think that's the first thing to point out, is that always do the best you can, and you should never, never be hard on yourself when you can't be perfect all the time, because there is probably a good reason why you might need a convenience food from time to time. As you say, that maybe you were taking care of other people during the day. And of course, it is important for you to take care of yourself, but maybe that one time, that's a good reason for you to have something that was prepared, or maybe isn't the healthiest, but like I said, to have it in a more mindful manner. So that's also, I think, would carry over into the rest of our meals. You know, I think one of the bigger things is that I see more people having sporadic meals, that maybe they're eating the right thing, but they aren't timing their meals, or they're not having them at certain times of day. And so that's also something that's very important, because if you plan, I'm going to have lunch, the likelihood of you planning what you're going to have for lunch and having the things that you need to prepare your lunch, that's much greater than if you don't know when your lunch is going to be. So there's a sort of preparedness in planning. So that would be the second thing. And then the last thing I'd say is that it's practice. And I love to cook, and I'm just a self-taught cook. It's not that I've taken any kind of formal classes in any way. And I had to teach myself, how much time does it take, and what kind of things do I need to be ready, and what makes me feel comfortable in the kitchen, and what are the foods that I know and the dishes that I know I can make and that I will feel really good, not that they are just good for me, but they also taste good. Mm-hmm. And that's not an overnight thing. So just as you know you have to practice getting better at everything you do, you've got to give yourself some time to practice knowing what is cooking at home like, and what are the things that you maybe you have three solid meals that you know you can make, and you know what time, how much time you need for those things. And again, kind of goes back to that preparedness, but you're much likely to be prepared if you've had the practice for it.
How about, I think we can't finish our conversation without talking about two important things, oil massage and breathing. So Abhyanga is that science of the oil massage, which I think is just incredible. Maybe you can explain the benefits of it and how to do it and why it's such a good possibly, or you know, thing for people to start doing, especially, you know, now as we move into fall, this is a time where it gets cold and dry, and that is certainly a good time to do these oils.
Mm-hmm. Abhyanga is the process of applying warm oil to your body, and there are also places that offer this as a service. So, for example, my health center offers this as a service, but it's something that you can do at home. And what you would do is apply warm oil to your body, and it's in a very specific way that you rub in a circular way around your joints, and as you're moving toward your heart, you make long strokes and then circle around joints again. And you're always moving from furthest from midline toward midline or toward your heart, from extremities toward your heart. And the oil is chosen based off of the season, your imbalance, your constitution. And it may also have, it may be an herbally infused oil, which then you're adding another layer to healing, and that those herbs that are within the oil will soak into your skin, will soak into your body, and provide another healing element for you as well. So we have the oil, which is great for us to feel, you know, I don't know many people that say, I just, you know, I have too much time for rest. And so this oil, the quality of oil, the heaviness and the warmth of it really gives the same quality as rest can. And I wouldn't say replace rest with oil, but applying that oil gives you a good sense of feeling more settled, more tethered, and more grounded, which so many of us need. And then you've got the herbal qualities of the oil that are also healing to the different tissues and organs within the body. And there's also the circulation component to it. You're aiding circulation, whether that's blood flow, lymphatic flow, which are also very important things to look at, especially our lymphatic system, as it's what's taking the bad things out of our body or pulling it from our body. And we want to have proper circulation. We don't have a pump for that system. So this is also great for the lymphatic system. And I think maybe even one of the best reasons for this practice is that not many of us just touch our own skin, or, you know, we hear stories about people having like a growth somewhere, like a tumor, a certain size. And you think to yourself, how could that person not know that they had a softball sized tumor or whatnot? And I think there are other reasons why we might not know, but just touching your own body gives you more information to how you're feeling, not to mention that touch itself is also quite healing. So there's so many reasons for this. And of course, this is the best as we're moving toward fall and winter. We're now officially in fall, that those qualities of the oil are very balancing to this season.
And then what about, we talked about breathing, because, you know, breathing is our portable stress reducer. The mind follows the breath. I've heard that in my yoga teacher talking about that. And many things like breathing has been shown to, is practiced in all sorts of meditation. So it's not certainly just yoga. But the breath is very powerful. It's portable and it's free, and you could do it. You could do it at a traffic light, you know. At a traffic
Absolutely.
Stop, you know.
Yeah, I think I love to think about breathing as it's the gateway from the outside and the inside, the external, our external body and our internal body, or turning inward. Right. So. Breathing, of course, can provide certain physical benefits, like maybe it's going to lower your heart rate, and or it's stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system, our rest and digest part of the nervous system. But we also have to look at how closely related our breathing is to the non-tangible, more of like our emotions and our mental qualities. And no one could deny that, because if you think of how you might react if there's an emergency, one of the first things you might do is to take a deep breath, and then you hear everything's okay, and then you exhale or you sigh. So if that's our body's natural response to things, we can use that to our advantage. And instead of breathing in a way that would provoke a state of emergency, we can breathe in a way that signals relief to our body.
Interesting. What about spending more time in nature? That's always a great way for me to reboot. Sometimes I'll purposefully having some kapha, drive a different way home, and stop by a waterfall or some beautiful thing in nature. If folks live in the city, well, they could still possibly find a park or some place that has some trees or water, and take part in nature. Nature is really rebooting.
Absolutely. And I think, one of the first things that we talked about today was how Ayurveda is based in nature. And wouldn't it make sense that the best healing we can do for ourselves, if we're trying to create synchronicity with nature, is to be in nature? And I live in a more urban area. I live in downtown Kansas City, where we really don't, I'm looking out the window now and I see a handful of trees, but I don't see any grass. But I could stay inside and look out the window, or I could go outside and my eyes can look at daylight directly and I can breathe outside air, or I could find a little grassy area and take off my shoes and go barefoot for a little bit, or touch a leaf or touch the bark of a tree. And that connection, even though it may not be as great as being able to escape to the mountains, let's say, that's still important. So that's, I think, something that we should all be doing every single day.
Taking part in nature has been now rebooted as almost like a new type of healing. They call it nature prescription. And I think even in Europe, for instance, many insurance companies and national healthcare plans are paying for that. In Japan, too, they call it forest bathing. So we're trying to move back towards nature to really help people.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So let's go through some, I'm sorry, let's go through some potential pathologies that people might have and how Ayurveda might help them. Of course, the tail end of your book, you talk about things like joint pain, for instance, is a big thing. Being a chiropractor, you do a lot of musculoskeletal work on patients. So you're, chiropractors are doctors of the nervous system, as my chiropractor tells me all the time. Mm-hmm. And but people come in and they have, inflammation in their joints. Now, again, you don't know whether they're pitta or kapha swelling or different types of, or even vata in the joints, but there are certain things that people with a lot of joint pains can do. What were some of those things that your book describes?
One thing that I talk about, and we've already discussed, is oil. That using a warm and, again, an herbally infused oil is really helpful, and you'd be using herbs that are better for the musculoskeletal system or the nervous system. So one of the go-tos for me is boswellia, or Indian frankincense, which can act to increase circulation without increasing inflammation. So it would decrease heat, but it also increases heat in a way, because it's creating movement within the body, or movement within the circulation. And I think that brings up another point, in that we have been trained to always go to ice for things that feel painful. And I wouldn't say that we should use heat on an acute injury necessarily, but I think that we have lost the idea that heat can actually be quite healing. And so sometimes if we aren't getting the proper blood flow to an area, or an area is very swollen, is it perhaps that there isn't great circulation moving through that area? So maybe there's swelling in the joint because the joint isn't moving. So could you give it sort of this external sort of movement with your hands to move that fluid out from the joint, which would then increase your ability to move it. And again, it's sort of like tripping the cycle. So I think heat is really underutilized because we, it was in like the late 70s that the acronym RICE, with rest, ice, compress, and elevate, was that term was coined. So that's, we've done more since then to know that heat can also heal. So using oil, using heat, those are two things that I really recommend. And of course, you have to always ask your doctor what they would be okay with you doing or allow you to do. But those are some things I think are so simple, and we don't need a lot of time for that. It could just be a 3-minute massage of the sore area.
I usually buy the Maharajan oil, or I forget how to say it.
Right. Maharajan is a very traditional oil in Ayurveda that is used for the musculoskeletal system. And I would say it is absolutely the go-to oil. It has a lot of herbs in it that are really great for nourishing muscles and joints.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our talk this morning. It's been great. Is there anything that you want to leave the listeners with, or some other parts of the book that we should explore in 4 or 5 minutes we have left?
Well, given the time of year that we're in, and I often offer this as a last little idea to take away, because I think that it's not looked at enough, is we're in the transition between summer and fall right now, and we should be paying attention to these transitions, not just in the seasons, but also throughout the day. So if you don't feel like you're someone that can implement a lot of extra things in your life, that maybe you can't incorporate more things for your health, is it possible that you could just stop at the transition of different activities or different points throughout your day, maybe between work and home or from one task to the next? And as you mentioned earlier, that breathing is so accessible for us, just to stop and take a couple of deep breaths, if that's between patients, between meetings, between picking up a child from one activity and taking them to the next, or being in your garage and going into your house, those little moments, these little pauses, could be really revolutionary.
Great. Well, I guess we could get your book anywhere at this point, right?
It's true, right.
So it's the Ayurvedic Self-Care Handbook, for those that have been busily taking notes during the program here. Holistic Healing Rituals for Every Day and Season to Boost and Stabilize Your Energy with Yogic Breathing. We talked about that. And this book gives over 100 daily and seasonal Ayurvedic rituals. We didn't even talk about some of the cool charnas that you make, which are kind of like herbal shakes with coconut milk, but they're warm, not cold, which is interesting, because I know starting your day with a smoothie that's, you know, ice cold fruit is frowned upon both in Chinese medicine and Ayurveda, because that damages the digestion fire. So nice warm, you know, as we transition into fall, nice warm things. Think about the fall. What are we, you know, what spices are associated with fall? What types of rituals do we have? Some of these things are really interesting, even in Western thinking, but they kind of maybe have ancient roots as well, like using cinnamon and cloves and cardamom and allspice and these types of things, because these are spices that are used in Ayurveda.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being a guest here, right here on the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z Show. We really appreciate it.
And thank you so much.
Yeah, we hope that people gain some great insight in how they can get a copy of the book and learn about everything from swishing with oil, like oil pulling in the mouth, to making your own Ayurvedic toothpaste. You have a great recipe for that. Boy, I tell you, it's just packed with great information. So thanks again for sharing and translating this mysterious Ayurvedic stuff into stuff that we all can understand. What a great service to humanity. And that's also a big part of Ayurveda, is your service to humanity. That's your dharma.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right.
Okay, thank you so much, Doc.
Thank you.
Okay. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Wishing you guys great health and happiness. Be well. Bye-bye.